We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Cold front approaches from the northwest, bringing chances for scattered thunderstorms to the region tomorrow afternoon and evening. High temperatures this afternoon will be in the 80s across much of the Midwest. Lows will be in the upper 50s and low 60s. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, sunny with a high of 85. The wind light and from the northwest. Tonight partly cloudy, the low 58 with a light southeast wind. Tomorrow mostly sunny and warmer, look for a high of 88. The wind from the south at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the low 68. The wind out of the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. The outlook for Wednesday, partly sunny and hot with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Expect a high around 90 and a southwest wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. Wednesday night, partly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms and a low in the upper 60s. At noon central time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana ranged from the upper 70s to the low 80s. Most locations reporting sunshine. At Rockford, 79 degrees. At O'Hare, 77. Bloomington and Mattoon reported 80 degrees. Carbondale checked in with light rain and 77 degrees. At South Bend, it was 77. 79 at Lafayette, 81 at Indianapolis and Terre Haute. Willard Airport reported 80 degrees at the top of the hour. The dew point, 56. The relative humidity, 43%. The wind light and variable. The barometric pressure, 30.10 and falling. The sky was mostly sunny. And at 12:39, 83 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. Pakistan is one of the most dangerous places in the world for women. A survey from the Thomson Reuters Foundation shows rape, mutilation, and honor killings are only part of the problem. Poor health also jeopardizes millions of Pakistani women. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports on the acute problems of rural women and one frontier hospital trying to improve their physical well-being in the culturally conservative Northwest.
In a landscape where decent clinics are scarce, the Umrana Mumtaz Healthcare Trust Hospital is a beacon of hope. Worried mothers wrapped in traditional white robes and headscarves clutch their ailing babies as they crowd a shaded amphitheater, a respite from the searing heat. More than 120,000 patients, mostly women and children, have received free basic health care at this facility since it opened just 3 years ago. The two-story philanthropic outpost was set up in the memory of a wife and mother. Hospital founder Mumtaz Ali says his wife's dying wish was to bring medical services to impoverished rural Pakistanis who he says cannot reach hospitals in the urban areas.
They couldn't afford it. We are right here on their doorstep.
Saleha Ahmed Ali has come here from her village several miles away seeking formula for her month-and-a-half-old twins, who look no bigger than kittens. The face of this young mother is already etched with the hardship of rural life. Saleha was only 11 when she married 8 years ago. Her two-year-old son Junaid appears robust, but Saleha cannot produce enough milk to feed her crying infants. The hospital's Dr. Kazem Nasruddin suspects she is malnourished. Dr. Kazem, as he's known here, says there's not enough food, and the typically short interval between pregnancies here doesn't give women time to recuperate.
And this is quite common. We often see 50 to 60% of the mothers, young mothers that we see with young babies are undernourished.
The women confirm that here in the northwest frontier, on the outskirts of the city of Mardan, the conservative culture often dictates that men eat first, the women last, which may mean just scraps. And many, like Saleha, face grueling daily regimens, which include the ordeal of fetching water, Dr. Kazem helps interpret for Saleha.
She has to bring portable water to home because they don't have a water supply at home.
Saleha is telling us she carries large earthen jars of water down from the side of a mountain 5 or 6 times a day. That takes about 3 hours out of her day just to get the water.
And when they get sick, they can't even take days off. She kept on doing those things, even while she was, you know, expecting.
Dr. Kazem says the challenge for Pakistan is to make men feel responsible for the well-being of their wives and families. He says members of the hospital staff, most of whom grew up in this conservative corner of the country, are trying to change the attitudes in the decidedly patriarchal Pashtun society. But he says it's delicate because they must not antagonize the men.
It's a very big challenge because, you know, they would consider that as part of their honor, the men. And if we take the side of the women, they would not see that as someone asking for more rights for the women. They would see that as someone who's trying to decrease the rights of the men in the society. They'd see it in the opposite way.
Husbands generally don't come to the hospital to discuss their wife's ill health or family planning.
Unless they're feeling ill themselves. And then they'll say, okay, it's a good opportunity, we can both go.
In the bright lobby of the Mumtaz Hospital, cranky toddlers clamber over weary mothers. At a rate of one patient every 8 minutes, they are shuttled off to the examination room to see one of 2 staff doctors. The huge caseload, some 120 plus patients per day, speaks to the trust the local population has in the hospital. But Dr. Kazem says that doesn't always translate into trust in male doctors. The taboo against women being touched by anyone other than their husband extends to male physicians. The hospital's one female doctor stepped down in June. Dr. Muhammad Arif Khan consults with Marcia, a 25-year-old expecting her first child. She's also anemic. It's her 3rd checkup here. But because Marcia will not allow Dr. Arif to perform a gynecological exam, it's not possible to know the full picture of her unborn baby's health. That must be a big handicap for you as a doctor when you're trying to treat pregnant women.
Yeah, this is a big handicap because we can't expose her. We will just examine her over the clothes.
Even an examination through her clothes takes negotiating with the hesitant mother-to-be. As Dr. Arif gently presses her belly, Marcia pulls her veil up to conceal her face. Marcia says she would be ashamed if a male doctor saw her unclothed, or if anyone knew she had been examined by a male doctor.
So the pressure on her is intense.
Yeah, it's intense pressure. You know, it's not only from the husband. Her mother-in-law, even her own mother will say that you should not go to the male doctor.
Dr. Arif says the time will come when women allow male doctors to touch them.
Yeah, this time is coming, inshallah. In the next 10, 15, 20 years, 20 years. But her children will do this, inshallah.
Her children will have a different attitude.
Yeah, they will have a different if they are educated.
If they're educated.
But the Mumtaz Hospital is already circumventing social restraints and improving women's health. With the help of technology and the internet, this hospital has developed its own virtual battalion of doctors across the globe that is sharing expertise online. Dr. Kazem says, we are never alone, and cites the case of a woman who had developed serious gynecological problems. He contacted the National University Hospital in Singapore, where an OBGYN doctor helped him treat the patient.
She corrected my misdiagnosis. After this, when another patient of the similar symptoms comes, I will know what to rule out. What happened was when we were starting, we faced many challenges and hurdles. But the thing is, we did not let ourselves be dragged down by those challenges.
This private endeavor in Pakistan, the dying wish of one privileged woman to improve the health of the rural poor, is now harnessing the world, treating problems, even problems that doctors here are not allowed to see. Julie McCarthy, NPR News.
When Congress reached a deal this summer to raise the debt ceiling, a lot of work was left undone. A super committee has until Thanksgiving to find a way to cut more than $1 trillion from the federal budget over the next decade. That committee is made up of 6 Republicans and 6 Democrats. One of those Democrats is a congressman from Southern California. His entire district is within the city of Los Angeles. NPR's Ina Jaffe has more.
As politicians go, Javier Becerra has a relatively low profile, considering that he's been in Congress for 18 years. He's the vice chair of the Democratic Caucus, the former head of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, and the first Latino to serve on the powerful Ways and Means Committee. When the Democrats had the House majority, Nancy Pelosi appointed him to the new post of assistant to the Speaker. There's a reason for Becerra's success, says California Congresswoman Grace Napolitano.
He works well with Republican and Democrat, not just on our side. And the respect that he has in Congress from other members is very evident because they do rely on his advice.
Becerra is also the top Democrat on the Subcommittee on Social Security, a program he said should be protected from cuts in an interview on ABC.
Do I believe that Republicans should succeed in cutting Social Security benefits for seniors when Social Security didn't add one single penny to these deficits and this national debt that we have today? I don't.
That interview took place before Congress made a deal on raising the debt ceiling, before there was a super committee. But in that same interview, Becerra sounded as if he knew what he'd soon be facing.
To be a true negotiator, you have to say, I'm willing to put my ego and my Kool-Aid aside and go to the negotiating table and try to reach out a deal with folks who I don't totally agree with.
Now that Becerra is on the nation's most closely watched panel of negotiators, you can expect him to work really, really hard at it, says Arturo Vargas, the executive director of the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials. More to the point, perhaps, Vargas has known Becerra since 1980, when they were both attending Stanford.
As a law student, he really hit the books and came across as sort of this clean-cut, Boy Scout, milk-drinking type of individual. In fact, was, I would say, a model student.
In recent elections, Becerra's won more than 80% of the vote in his district. But during his career, he's also faced political setbacks, arguably of his own making. During his first term in Congress, he took on the late legendary congressional power broker Dan Rostenkowski, unsuccessfully opposing him over cuts in benefits to legal immigrants. Later, his trip to Cuba caused Republican lawmakers from Florida to quit the Hispanic caucus he then led. Reportedly, he even got on the wrong side of his mentor, Nancy Pelosi, when he complained that party leaders had too quickly abandoned the public option in the health care overhaul. But what some analysts have seen as mistakes, Arturo Vargas sees as a plus.
I think the fact that he's willing to stand up to his leadership, to be a maverick, has earned him respect. I think it will serve him well on this super committee because it sends a signal that he's not just going to toe the party line.
There will have to be a